listening to This Week in Health Innovation on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm Greg Masters, Managing Director of Health Innovation Media and your host. On today's broadcast, my guests include Jerry Penso, MD, MBA, President and CEO at the American Medical Group Association, also known as AMGA. AMGA is a trade association that represents medical groups and other organized systems of care, including some of the nation's largest, most influential integrated healthcare delivery systems. Dr. Penso previously served as Chief Medical and Quality Officer for AMGA and President of AMGA's Foundation. Under his leadership, the impact of AMGA's quality programs grew to improve care for 26 million patients. Chet Speed, JDLLM, is the Chief Policy Officer at AMGA. Previously, Mr. Speed served as the Executive Director for Federal Government Relations for the Cleveland Clinic, where he represented the clinic before Congress and the executive branch. Mr. Speed also served as a Senior Counsel to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Counsel to the Inspector General in Washington, D.C. In this role, he negotiated corporate integrity agreements and participated in the global settlements of federal False Claims Act cases. Today, we'll dive into AMGA's Taking Risk 4.0, Clearing a Pathway to Value-Based Care. So let's start at the beginning. What is the American Medical Group Association, otherwise known as AMGA? And for those in the audience who may be unfamiliar with the body of your work, give us some history on the genesis of the association, its mission, vision, and values, and any evolution to date. So, who wants to start?
Greg, this is Jerry, and thank you, first of all, for having us on the podcast today. AMGA, we're a trade association, and we've been around nearly 70 years, and we represent medical groups and other organized systems of care, including some of the nation's largest and most influential integrated healthcare delivery systems. So that includes members like Mayo, Cleveland Clinic, Kaiser Permanente, Geisinger, Sutter, Cedars-Sinai, Intermountain, and over 400 other prominent delivery systems. The average size of our member group is 400 physicians, so they're relatively large, established, and often they're even the largest employer in their communities. Altogether, our members include 175,000 physicians who practice in our member organizations, and they deliver care to one in three Americans. AMGA was born in the 1950s out of a desire of physicians who were practicing in these type of groups. They were novel back then, and they wanted to get together to improve the quality of patient care by sharing best practices, experiences, and strategies with their peers. So our mission hasn't really changed that much in the last 70 years, and we really want to promote that our model of care, this organized, coordinated care, is the preeminent model for American health in the 21st century. And we work in that way, especially with our advocacy and all of our quality programs, to promote our model of care and the move to value.
Excellent. And I noted in the details of the survey that there were at least two IPAs that responded. Are you finding IPAs are still active in risk contracting and value-based healthcare?
Oh, definitely. IPAs are part of, if you will, sort of the healthcare ecosystem that includes everything from medical groups to hospital-affiliated system. Now there's for-profit entities as well as IPAs and clinically integrated networks. They're all part of that healthcare ecosystem, and all of them at different rates and different styles are moving to value.
And would the core be risk-bearing primary care medical groups, or is it a different complement?
You know, we like to describe all of our members as snowflakes. If you've seen one, you've seen one. They're all a little bit different depending on their market, their history, their culture, and the same as with their regards to move to value. Some of them have been in risk-bearing capitation for decades. Some of them have been new to this and are learning with some of the, if you will, lower risk type of ECOs. And it, a lot of that does depend on their overall market and their strategy.
Excellent. So, Chet, do you want to weigh in up front in terms of your role at AMGA, especially at the federal scene?
Sure. Thanks, Greg, and appreciate being on the call as well. My name is Chet Speed. I'm the Chief Policy Officer at AMGA. And AMGA has a fairly unique advocacy agenda. It really is focused on the group practice side of our large health systems. And we don't really advocate around the economic models in fee-for-service. We have what we call a value agenda. And we'll get into this, of course, later on the risk survey, but the risk survey has really helped us develop our policies around value. And when we think about value, when we go to Congress, we talk about the need for data sharing between our members and indeed all providers with health insurance companies, because it is very difficult to manage a patient population in a value-based arrangement without knowing all the information that there is around your patients. And we talk about the need to harmonize quality measures. Some of our members report to us that they report 800 measures to various payers, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, and the commercial payers. And frankly, that's too many. You know, we need to get quality measures back to what they were intended to do, which is to actually measure and improve quality. AMGA had a key role in actually creating the ACO program, the MSSP program, during the ACA. So there's some pride of ownership there, and there are some changes that the ACO program needs that allow our members to be successful in both quality and financial ways. So we talked to Congress about the need to modernize that program, and we also support Medicare Advantage because I think we'll talk about this later. Medicare Advantage is where our members are truly going, in the federal setting at least, as far as a value-based payment model.
That seems to be where the growth is. Let me ask you this. I think it's fair to say, or let me pose it as a question, when we talk value-based health care, that seems to enjoy some bipartisan support in Washington. Is that a correct statement?
It is a correct statement. Yeah, I laugh for a reason. It is a correct statement. If you ask any member of Congress or senator, do you support value in health care, and they'll say yes. Now, if you dig deeper, what does value mean to them, they may not be able to answer the question. Now, I think the typical member of Congress, when they think of healthcare, they think of sort of the old setting, at least as far as we're concerned, you know, a physician in a small practice that admits his or her patients to the community hospital. That's what they usually think of. You know, obviously, our view is much different when you represent Cleveland Clinic and Mayo, which is a truly integrated systems of care. That's really sort of focused on, you know, creating infrastructure to improve their care and create better outcomes.
Excellent. So that's a great starting point. Let's then maybe talk about what is the AMGA's definition of value-based healthcare. Some suggest this can be a spectrum of arrangements. How does AMGA see the space?
So I'll again look to the risk survey. When we asked our members what risk arrangements they were in, we asked them that exact question, you know, what do you consider value-based arrangements? And so we broke them up the way we define value arrangements in the risk survey. And on the federal setting, we look at ACOs. And in 2018, we asked, are you upside or downside risk ACOs? We look at Medicaid managed care, bundled payments, as well as Medicare Advantage. And they also ask you about fee-for-service. In a commercial setting, it's very similar. It's capitated payments, full and partial payments, and commercial ACOs, we call them shared savings, which is, you know, obviously no downside risk, or shared risk, which is downside risk. And then we ask about our bundled payments as well. So that's how we define value arrangements, at least for purposes of our risk survey. And that seems to, the members seem to be happy with those definitions.
Let's walk into the survey. Let's talk about some of the insights derived and why there might be a preference of one particular expression of value-based healthcare versus another, commercial, Medicare, bundles.
So we started the risk survey in 2015 because, you know, the members had at least said to us anecdotally that they were going into Medicare Advantage. And also at that point in time, the federal ACO program had been in operation for 2 to 3 years. And there were indications that the members were really moving to value in a much larger way. And we created a survey to really validate whether our members were moving to value, as well as to identify some impediments to making that transition. And what was interesting this year in 2018, actually, was that we compared our initial results in 2015 to 2018. And what was very clear was that the members are definitely making a thoughtful, intentional move towards value. You know, fee-for-service revenues are decreasing compared to where they were in 2015. The revenue percentages in risk-based arrangements increased dramatically. And what was also notable was that Medicare Advantage is the clear preference for our members as far as entering value-based arrangements in the federal space, whereas ACOs haven't looked to as an opportunity to learn experience, learn how to take risk. I think the members have found some difficulties in succeeding from a quality and financial standpoint in the federal MSSP program, and I started looking at Medicare Advantage as a much better program to succeed with improving the care of their patients as well as succeeding financially. And what's also interesting is that when you compare where the members were as far as those that were ready to take risk in 2 years, downside risk in 2 years, the percentage went from 42% to 74%, which means that the members are gearing up to take downside risk in a much greater way than they were just 4 years ago. There are impediments to moving to risk. At some level, they're at the payer level. Payers aren't really keen to share administrative claims data with their members, and it's very difficult to manage a patient population without that data. And there's also internal impediments to moving to value. You know, our members need to create an infrastructure that lets them take risk, and that means changing care management processes, investing in IT and people to analyze data. Our members are largely taking care of their internal impediments, but the external impediments are the payer level ones to remain. So that's where we stand. I think there's a real, the big takeaways are a real move, an intentional move to value, addressing of internal impediments, and there are some external ones that remain.
So Jerry, let me ask you this. Earlier you cited some of your members, which include trophy nameplates of integrated delivery systems anyone in the healthcare space would immediately recognize. Do you sense, and having been involved, I know, here in San Diego at Sharp, in this movement going back a while, do you sense that there's increasing momentum to actually fulfill the promise of value-based healthcare from perhaps prior periods? And if so, what do you trace it to? Is it more involvement of physician leadership? Is it culture? Is it technology, infrastructure? Or is it just this mandated transformation that is no longer optional for leadership?
When we asked our members in the risk survey why they were moving to value, they told us, because we were curious, is this a repeat of the 1980s where there was managed care and then it pulled back and we went backwards, if you will, towards fee-for-service and PPOs? Or is this one, if you will, going to move towards value and continue in that direction? They told us a variety of answers, but the answers in general were that they felt this time it was real, that this time it's going to mean that they are going to change how they practice. As Chet mentioned, they are making the investments, so they're putting their resources in the direction of value. They're investing in information technology, in leadership, in changing their culture, in changing their care management processes to prepare themselves for value. And they're looking for partners in the health plans as well as the government that want to be long-term partners in moving that direction. And why is the question, why do they think this time they need to move in that direction? I think there's a lot of factors. One is the external environment. They've seen the strong signals coming from CMS and other government entities that tell them that they are strongly moving towards value. They also are getting more pressure from their commercial carriers to look at the affordability and to manage care differently if they want to remain in their preferred networks. In addition, I think just overall looking at the cost of care, employers are putting more pressure on the system as well and beginning to, through their coalitions, look at different alternatives. And then finally, the consumers are playing a role here too. I think the consumers can only bear so much cost and are looking for newer and better alternatives and to make sure that their health care is affordable for them and their families. Our groups are also sensitive to the marketplace and don't want to be the last ones in the market to move to value. So that's another thing. They're thinking it as a strategic move as well.
And I would imagine with this quality pool of membership participation that you have opportunities to generate best practices within some of these strategic questions. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. We One of the advantages of being in a trade association like AMGA is that our members get to network with their C-level peers and find out what their peers are doing, what they're doing both to prepare for value, what lessons they're learning from each other, and how to apply those lessons to their own organization, their own unique organizations and unique marketplaces. So definitely, we think we have a host of best practices. We have them on our website. We have them at our meetings and our speakers to help our groups understand what are the lessons learned, what are the barriers to moving to value, and what are the success stories as well.
Excellent. So Jerry, let's talk a little bit about MA versus ACOs in the, shall we say, quiver of strategies. Can you compare and contrast the two, at least based on the insights your members have provided you through this survey?
Greg, I've practiced in both models. I was at Sharp Healthcare in San Diego. We were very involved in full-risk capitated Medicare Advantage. And in addition, we were one of the initial groups that were in the Pioneer ACO program and later transitioned to a next-gen program. So I can tell you from firsthand experience as well as what I'm hearing from our members. Medicare Advantage is definitely becoming the clear preference for our member groups. It's got predictable rules. There's complete alignment of the payment model and the care model that they want to deliver for their patients. And because it's a predictable payment model, they can make the strategic investments in information technology, quality improvement, analytics, and care management. The ACO model, you know, one of the things that's a clear disadvantage is the length of time that it takes between the end of the performance year and by the time that the payment, be it shared savings or shared risk, is adjudicated and then returned back to the group. And because of that, it makes it very hard to make those upfront payments when you may not receive your payment for a year, year and a half after the end of the year that you just performed. In addition, there's the regulatory framework, especially on the federal side, that's changing, sometimes changes midstream. In addition, ACO is built on a fee-for-service chassis, so it's very difficult often to... You have to follow a lot of the fee-for-service rules that are in Medicare as opposed to the Medicare Advantage where there's a lot more flexibility. In addition, there's just some structural issues with the ACOs that still need more work like attribution, risk adjustment, and benchmarking that can inhibit. And, you know, the other thing that comes to mind with Medicare Advantage, remember, Medicare Advantage, the patient's sign up for that program. So they know that they're involved and they're much more engaged. Because of that, in the Medicare Advantage, you usually have a network of physicians and providers that the patients can see within the network. In the ACO program in the federal rules, the patients are free range. They can see any physician within Medicare, and those out of network, or if you will, out of your system's ACO costs still come back to your ACO. And often the patients may not even be aware that they're in an ACO and part of that accountability. So I think our groups definitely have found that Medicare Advantage is the preferred model moving forward toward value.
It seems to afford more control and create some additional opportunities for benefit flexibility, whereas that may not be the case in terms of an ACO, but perhaps some of the modifications that have been proposed are starting to make ACOs look a little move closer in the direction of the Medicare Advantage plans. So is this a binary choice? Need it be an either or could these be parallel initiatives inside a single entity?
I think our groups are still trying to figure that out. Do they have an MA strategy for those patients who choose to join Medicare Advantage? And for those who are in a traditional, who want to stay with traditional Medicare, do they have an ACO or are they part of a SIN that's part of an ACO? They're still trying to figure out the pros and cons of, if you will, that dual strategy. But again, I think if they... are trying to shift their bets and trying to move market share, I think they want to move towards the Medicare Advantage route.
Excellent. So, Chet, in the value-based toolshed, Jerry's addressed ACOs and Medicare Advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Give us some insight what the survey says around bundled payments, MACRA, MIPS. What have you learned?
Sure. And so it's really interesting when you think about bundles. You know, bundles are in the news quite frequently. They seem to be a very favored model from the federal government and CMS standpoint. I think CMS just rolled out a bundled payment model around radiation therapy a few days ago, which actually be mandatory across parts of the country. You know, our members have consistently reported to us that there's little traction with them and bundles. And we asked the question, you know, why is only 1% of your risk revenues around bundles? And they gave us some, when you think about the way our groups are constructed, it actually makes sense. You know, they'll tell you that, you know, if you're a community hospital with a strong orthopedic, you know, practice or practices around, you know, bundles make sense. It's a very discreet, small population type of pilot. But our members, they have literally, you know, over a million patient admissions every year or patient visits every year. And conceptually, our members want to take risk on a very large patient population. They have the infrastructure to do so. They have a strong primary care basis. They have every specialty that they need. And I think, frankly, they view bundles as a distraction because you just have, you know, for instance, cardiologists or orthopedics saying we want to take, you know, our small patient population and focus on them. Whereas at the leadership level of our groups, they really want to look at much larger patient populations. You can improve care and save costs only when you have a very large N of patients. So bundled payments just have not been attractive for our members at all.
Got it. And what about the express preference for MIPS versus participating in the advanced alternative payment model?
Sure. I think they looked at MIPS. Originally, MIPS was supposed to be a value-based transition tool. When you looked at the percentage of payments that would be at risk, it went from 4% to 9%. And our members looked at that, the MIPS program, as something that, well, you know, we have invested in all the infrastructure to improve care and presumably do well in the MIPS program. And they really looked at, they predicted, you know, pretty nice returns on those investments as part of the MIPS program. That has not happened because CMS has excluded so many providers from the MIPS program. You know, essentially, when they're looking at when they were predicting a 5% increase in their Part B revenues, it really was only a 1% increase because all of the excluded providers from the program. But when they look at APMs, you know, a lot of our members are in either MSSP or Next Gen. But I think they look at some of the requirements around APMs are very difficult to meet. There are revenue and patient beneficiary thresholds that have to be met. And quite frankly, and if you talk to, you know, the Hills folks, they'll admit this, those revenue thresholds were arbitrarily chosen. And quite frankly, even our most advanced members who are into a lot of risk products, you know, they can't meet a 50% APM revenue threshold in, you know, 2020. It just doesn't reflect an accurate sense of what the markets are doing right now. So they are not in APMs as much as they would like to be, only because they can't meet these revenue and beneficiary choice patient number thresholds. I think they look at, CMS came out with, they basically restructured the entire MSSP program just late last year. You know, our members are looking at that program now and deciding whether they want to stay in MSSP, whether they want to leave MSSP. You know, can they take the increased levels of risk in the program? So I think there's a lot of uncertainty around the APM program right now, which is why you see, you know, the unknown answer to our survey was as high as it was.
So would it be fair to say that strategy here is more about, or choice in terms of options and strategies, is more about the art of the possible in terms of where you are in the moment as to which direction you're going to go?
I think that's fair to say. Yeah, I think it's fair to say. I think what our members are looking for is stability and predictability. And I think Jerry touched on this earlier. I think that's why they like Medicare Advantage, because that is a predictable, stable payment platform. When you look at MSSP or these other APMs, I mean, honestly, the rules change seemingly every year. And if you're a CEO or a CFO or a chief medical officer, it is hard to plan a very large-scale value program when the rules change seemingly every year, or in some case with one of the larger ACO pilots, some of those rules changed in mid-year.
Right. So no likely strategic reversal here anytime soon. Ambiguity in Washington notwithstanding. So how could we maybe distill out essentially the key takeaways, key learnings from the survey, and use that to inform some of the strategic choices that exist out there for entities at different levels of evolution with respect to their ability to assume and survive under risk contracting?
So some of the key learnings, and I'm sure Jerry will jump in. The key learnings are, one, first, get your own house in order. You know, create the infrastructure internally that allows you to take risk. Redesign your primary care practices, develop the processes that can treat a chronically ill patient population, invest in the IT and the analytics. I mean, these are multi-million dollar investments. And Jerry mentioned this earlier, you need to address the change management challenges, which are massive, when basically telling very smart people like physicians and advanced practitioners that they need to deliver care in a different way and be paid for it in a different way. So get your own house in order. Find a willing partner in the payer community that is willing to share claims data with you, that is willing to basically find places where you can succeed value-based arrangement. Work with AMGA to work with federal officials to make a viable MSSP program going forward. Those are some of the things that I would think are strategic, and also look to Medicare Advantage.
Jerry, anything to add?
Yeah, it's clear our members are moving to value, and they're making those strategic investments. Just the percentage that state that they can move to downside risk in the next 2 years indicates that they're ready. And they're waiting for the other healthcare players, like pharma, like devices, like insurance, to engage even more with them. They want those other stakeholders to join them, whether it's the government removing some of those impediments or commercial payers sharing data. Those are just two examples. But, they're surprisingly optimistic about the future when I go visit members across the country. And they realize that they're going to move to these value-based models, and they're also very excited about the innovations that are happening in medicine that are going to help them give even better care, like telemedicine, new care models that will improve patient outcomes. We have a conference coming up in September of 19, our Institute of Quality Leadership in Las Vegas, where we'll be discussing those. So I think you're going to see that even though they're frustrated by the pace of change and some of the impediments, they are optimistic about the type of care that they're offering to their patients and their communities as we move forward towards value.
And that will be the last word on today's broadcast. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Jerry Pensel, President and CEO at AMGA, and Mr. Chet Speed, AMGA's Chief Policy Officer. Do follow their work on the web via www.amga.org and on Twitter via @TheAMGA and Dr. Penso @JPENSO, #1. Be sure and check out their Risk Contracting Readiness Report, quote, Taking Risk 4.0, Clearing a Pathway to Value-Based Care, end quote. This can be accessed on the AMGA's website. For This Week in Health Innovation, Healthcare Now Radio, this is Greg Masters saying bye now.